1-800-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Once again, everyone, welcome. Nice to have you with us. It's the Friday edition of It's Your Turn. Yes, the weekend is here, or almost at least, especially now that we're into the afternoon hours of a Friday. And it's the first weekend in November, of course. Also the weekend when we change the clocks. I don't know of too many people who look forward to that, going back to standard time. I suppose there are some. I like daylight time. I like that extra daylight in the evening, even though that has been dwindling rapidly here in the last few weeks. The daylight hours have really shortened up. But we changed the clocks this weekend. You move your clocks back an hour before you go to bed tomorrow night. Technically, the time changes at 2 a.m. on Sunday morning. I know of no one who gets up at 2 a.m. Sunday morning just to change their clocks. No, you do it before you go to bed on Saturday night. But the good news is we get an extra hour of sleep. Make up for that hour of sleep you lost back in the spring when we changed to daylight time. We have a lot more of the calendar year on daylight saving time these days than we used to. If you've been around on this planet for a while, you know that we used to revert to standard time much earlier in the fall. Seems to me it was early October we used to change. And we used to change back to daylight time later in the spring. But for the past several years now, we've changed on the first Sunday in November. So that's this Sunday. Change the clocks. And then come April, early April, we'll go back to daylight time. Also a good idea to check the batteries, change the batteries in your smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors. Always a good idea to do that. And a reminder from the Game Commission, boy, this is a dangerous time of the year for deer out on the roadways for a number of reasons. First of all, we have the early twilight now, the early darkness, and deer like to move as it begins to get dark, dusk. Same thing in the pre-dawn hours, by the way, if you're up early and driving. So you have that to consider. It's also the mating season now for deer, and they're on the move, and they're also out feeding a great deal more because they're trying to store energy for the coming winter while food is available. So deer are on the move. This time of year, be extra careful, because it's going to be a big difference come Sunday evening when it starts to get dark about 5 o'clock once we change the clocks. So enjoy. We've been through this before. We'll make it. You realize that we are less than 3 weeks away from Thanksgiving now. Thanksgiving 3 weeks from yesterday. Yeah, it all comes fast and furious here. I noticed for the first time today, I was looking out the window, actually late this morning. Here at work, I was looking out the window across at the hillside and the south side of Butler, and the first time I've noticed an entire hillside now with splotches of color. You know, now we've seen over the past couple of weeks the occasional tree, you know, the bright red tree or the yellow tree, but really starting to change now. They're muted. The colors are muted. It's not going to be a spectacular fall foliage season, and obviously we're several weeks late because of the very strange weather that we've had. Up until a couple of weeks ago, it was quite warm, and of course, I don't have to tell you, it's been quite wet. But there is some color now, so if you're out and about over the next few days, you know, and especially if you get outside the city and you can look, take a look over the hills, enjoy the color. I don't think it's going to be there very long this year. Once those leaves start to turn, with the rain we've been getting, they're probably going to come down pretty quickly. So enjoy. We have a lot of ground to cover today on the It's Your Turn program. We're going to be covering a variety of different subjects. Some days we spend a lot of time on a particular subject. Today we're going to spend a little bit of time on a great number of subjects, including a book about maps that has come out from National Geographic. It's about maps. It's a collection of maps. Some of them are very old. Some of them are very artful. Excellent maps. All kinds of maps. We'll talk about that. In fact, our first guest, Betsy Mason, will be chatting with us about maps here in just a few minutes. Also today, we're going to be talking about diabetes in pets. Yes, pets can get diabetes. And we'll talk about how to handle that. There are ways to manage it, and your pets will be able to live a normal life. Also this week, was it Tuesday, at the word game of the death in prison of mobster Whitey Bulger. He had been convicted of numerous murders. Bad guy, no question about it. But he had managed to escape authorities, and he lived, it was in Southern California. He was living for 10 years or so. Nobody knew who he really was. Suddenly he was, authorities discovered him and took him into custody, and he went on trial, and he was convicted, and he went to prison, and he was killed by inmates in the prison that he was transferred to. He was transferred, and one day later, they found him dead, beaten to death. I had mentioned to you, I believe, perhaps I was talking with my morning colleague, Kate, that I had done an interview with a former FBI agent who was instrumental in hunting down Whitey Bulger. This is some years ago now, several years ago. And I wondered if I still had it in the archives. Well, I do. I did. I found it. I hunted for it yesterday, and I thought we'd take a second listen to that interview. It's not really, really long. Robert Fitzpatrick is the former special agent with the FBI who was involved in hunting down Whitey Bulger. Now, obviously, we're listening to an interview that I did several years ago. So, in fact, it was before Bulger even went to trial. So it's a little bit dated, but it's interesting to find out how they found him after he was all those years hiding in plain sight, so to speak. It wasn't like he went to, you know, South America or somewhere like that. So Robert Fitzpatrick, we'll be visiting with him. Also today, we're going to be talking about a spectacular collection of photographs from the archives of National Geographic. And we'll be talking with one of the staff photographers from National Geographic. I've never talked with a National Geographic shooter before. His name is Mark Thiessen. He'll be with us. And still more on the program today, Leadership Hacks with Scott Stein. So as I said, we have a lot of ground to cover here today, and it'll be a good program, I think. We'll take a break, and then when we come back, we'll talk with Betsy Mason about maps, all kinds of maps. One of our sponsors on the program today is Suburban Animal Clinic. They are on Route 8 South of Butler at Thorncrest Drive, right at the intersection with Thorncrest Drive. They offer a wonderful range of services for your pet, obviously. Regular checkups for your dog or your cat or your bird or even exotic pets. They also offer surgical care if needed, dental care, laser therapy, prescription diets, microchipping, and if you have an emergency with your pet, they can help you with that as well. They've been serving people in our area for more than 60 years. Suburban Animal Clinic, 101 Thorncrest Drive. If you're headed south down Route 8 from Butler, as soon as you pass all the auto dealerships, start looking on the left-hand side and you'll see them. Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8 South at Thorncrest Drive. Suburban Animal Clinic. They also offer some other things, too. Microchipping, as we say. And you can also find out about chiropractic care for your pet. Yes. Grooming services. Yes. And even information about dog obedience classes as well. Give them a call if you need more information. Suburban Animal Clinic, 724-287-5289. 724-287-5289.
Dr. Andrew Szabo of Butler Health System with the story of a remarkable recovery.
Joe's never the kind to be still for long. A hernia can stop that in a hurry. The technology we use makes surgery less invasive, and that makes recovery less challenging. That's a big investment for a community hospital. But then again, we're not the average community hospital.
At Butler Health System, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care. But more importantly, we know why we have to.
Going to be talking about maps, listeners, on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Betsy Mason. She is a co-author of a new book, a gorgeous book, published by National Geographic Books. It's called All Over the Map.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
This will be a godsend for map people. By the way, I am a map person. I have been collecting maps for years, all sorts of them, not just in book form, but even those, you know, folding maps that you used to be able to get for free at the gas station and now you have to pay $5 for. I love to look at maps. I really do. I find it very fascinating. And I just got the review copy of your book. Actually, it just came in this morning, so I'm still in the process of reviewing it. And, boy, there's gorgeous stuff in here. First of all, Betsy, it's a big book. My goodness, coffee table book, right?
Yeah, it's big. We wanted it to be large format so we could show the maps off better.
Mm-hmm. Your co-author is Greg Miller. Where did the concept from this book come from, Betsy? Was it was it commissioned by you, or was it your idea, or what happened there?
Well, Greg and I have been writing about maps together for about 5 or 6 years. We started a blog about maps when we were working at Wired Magazine. And so we just started exploring maps by following our curiosity and using our journalistic skills to uncover interesting stories about maps. And so we moved the blog to National Geographic a couple years back, and then we decided to collaborate with them on a book because we just were finding far too many interesting stories than we could ever fit on the blog. So a book seemed like a really great place to put some of these wonderful stories that we've overturned over the years.
I think the first time that I became really intrigued by maps was way back in probably junior high school in history class when I first read about this guy called Amerigo Vespucci. I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but he was a map maker, as I recall, and in fact, the Americas are named after him, right?
That's right. And a lot of places are actually named after the explorer map makers who were sort of the first to lay it down on paper.
I didn't know that. I knew about Amerigo, but I didn't know about any others. I'm sure you have, despite the fact that you have hundreds of maps in here, you probably have some favorites, don't you, Betsy? Can you talk about a couple of those for us?
I do. I have so many favorites. I guess one of my favorite maps of all time was the first one on my list for this book when we decided to make it. It's a map of the world ocean floor that shows the mid-ocean ridges where the tectonic plates are being pulled apart and new crust is being formed. Wow. This map was made by a female cartographer, actually, named Marie Tharp, and she was a geologist and worked with another geologist named Bruce Hazen, and because he was a man, he was allowed to go out on ships and collect data. And they used this data that they got with soundings of the ocean floor to put together the first picture of the ocean floor that looks like anything that people can understand. And before this, people sort of thought the ocean floor was a vast, featureless plain. But on this map, you can see that there are mountain ranges and trenches. And they also got a wonderful Austrian artist named Heinrich Baran to paint this map. And so the end result is just, I think, an artistic masterpiece that also has an important place in history. So that's certainly one of my favorites.
Well, I knew that women were discriminated against in the workplace in a lot of ways. I didn't know that it applied to map makers as well, to cartographers, for goodness sakes.
Oh, yes. Well, there are more female cartographers throughout history than we know. They often didn't get credit for the maps they made. And this map was made, or Marie Tharp's maps were made in the mid-20th century. And she was lucky to have even gotten a degree in geology. She was only admitted because World War II had taken all the potential male candidates for the geology programs. And so some of them started admitting women. Mm. And she managed to find her way into cartography and ended up making this masterpiece.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other maps that I've already spotted and know that I'm going to look at in more detail. One of your chapters is on waterways, and there's a wonderful map in there about the epic quest for a Northwest Passage by the early explorers. Mm-hmm. And in fact, as I recall from my my history classes way back in high school, wasn't Henry Hudson looking for the Northwest Passage when he sailed up what became known as the Hudson River? I think that's correct.
I'm not sure, but I know lots and lots of people were. I mean, it was basically the early 16th century after Christopher Columbus had sailed, you know, in one direction, hoping to come around the globe and get to the east. When he hit a huge landmass known as North America, from that moment on, people started dreaming about an easier way to get to Asia from Europe. And so going through over the North Pole seemed like the way to go. And of course, that just wasn't possible for a long time because of all the ice. So many, many people died trying to find the Northwest Passage. And also, many maps were made of how people imagined there might be a Northwest Passage. Many, many of them are false, of course, and people found that out the hard way. But we actually do have a Northwest Passage now. Climate change has made it so that there is an ice-free passageway that people can travel in the summer.
You have many other maps that take us back into history, which I find fascinating. You also have maps that might be used in the future. For example, of some places in space, right? Mapping the moon, mapping Mars, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, we've got maps from all over the universe, I guess you could say. In fact, we even have a map that was sent out into interstellar space by NASA on their Voyager spacecraft. It's a map that locates the solar system within the universe, and the idea was that if any aliens managed to find this map, they would be able to understand where the solar system is. Now, before you get concerned about that, it's obviously a very, very low likelihood that anyone will find this tiny spacecraft that's 13 billion miles away from us right now, but they used these old dying stars called pulsars that have very unique flashing signatures to show any intelligent species that might come across it where exactly we are in the universe.
Talk about going back in history. I haven't had a chance to explore this one closely yet, but you have a map called The Rise and Fall of America's Booze Ban, which depicts the, you know, as prohibition spread across the country. I never thought I'd see a map about that, Betsy.
Yeah, we have several maps, and it's interesting. Some of the maps are from before and during the Prohibition, so they portray alcohol as very terrible and, you know, as a scourge that is taking over New York in particular. And then afterwards, there's a post-Prohibition map that is of the state of inebriation, and it shows the Isle of Pleasure, and it has a much different take on alcohol. There's even the Gulf Stream, and in it there's a sea monster called Old Delirium Tremens.
Do you talk anything about the different types of maps? I mean, you know, when sometimes you look at a map of the world, and Greenland and Antarctica are enormous, much bigger than they really are, but it's because you're trying to show something that's three-dimensional on a two-dimensional page, right?
That's right. Every map that is flat is distorted in one way or another because you can't take a curved surface and make it flat without ripping it or squishing it or distorting it in some way. So there are all sorts of different ways that you can decide to distort the surface of the Earth to make it flat. And one of the most common ways is called the Mercator projection. And you see a lot of maps on this projection, and what the problem with this one is that it distorts the land masses near the poles and makes them much, much larger than they actually are relative to the places that are near the equator. Like you mentioned, Greenland looks like it's about the same size as South America, when in fact it's only 1/8 the size of South America. But other projections attempt to minimize some of that distortion. So you'll see that they curve in towards the north and south pole to take care of that a little bit. But you're going to distort something, either the size, the shape, the angle of the continents, and it's really up to the map maker. And I think that that's a good thing for people to understand, that every map they see is distorted in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. And when you're trying to distort as little as possible, you get that world map that has the triangles cut out of it at the top and the bottom all over the place.
Yeah, that's one way to minimize distortion, is to just cut it into pieces and and have blank space in between parts. And one of the ones that we have in the book is shaped as a butterfly. It's actually one of my favorite projections. It minimizes distortion of the shapes and areas of the continents, but of course it introduces giant gaps between parts of the ocean.
You have a map in here, and I'm hopping around only in the interest of time, because we don't have too much time to talk with Betsy here, but you have a map of Jerusalem in the time of Christ. That is fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah, this map is actually based on some previous maps, but a lot of it is based on the cartographer's imagination of what Jerusalem must have looked like at the time. So there's a lot of interesting things in there. And what I find really interesting is how this map and lots of maps of the day, even maps that were more realistic, are really detailed looks at the city that the mapmaker was in, and then everything else around it is sort of almost fudged a little. It's very vague and not very detailed. It's almost as if these mapmakers felt like the city they were focusing on was the center of the world.
Maps of the wind. Well, wait a minute, Betsy. The wind is invisible. How did people ever map the wind?
Well, that's one of the great things about maps, is that it can show things that aren't just actual geographic places, like wind or poverty or where tourists take photos, all sorts of things like that. These wind maps are made from data from all sorts of different places, like NOAA. And they just collect the data and show in real time how fast and which direction the wind is flowing all over the world. And the end result is just this beautiful sort of swirling mass of green and blue lines that are tracking all over the globe. It's really pretty.
How about maps that chronicle the changing nighttime illumination of the world over a period of years? These, I assume, come from satellite photographs, Betsy?
Yeah, this comes from some NASA satellites, and this is a great example of how maps can tell a story. This shows the change in nighttime lighting between 2012 and 2016, and you can see that in India there's all sorts of new light shown in yellow, where India's been trying to electrify a lot of its rural areas. And then if you look over in Syria, you can see lots of blue areas which show where lights have dimmed or gone out, which obviously is due to the ongoing civil war there. So you can learn a lot about what's going on just by looking at one aspect of human life, and in this case it's artificial lighting.
Even a map of Nellie Bly's trip around the world. A Pittsburgh gal, by the way, from western Pennsylvania. One final thing I want to talk to you about before our time runs out, and that's the art of map making, because many of these maps are works of art, Betsy. They're gorgeous.
Oh, they are. So many of them are just truly beautiful works of art in their own right. And we really tried to include not just maps that are beautiful or visually captivating in some way. They all are. But all of the maps in the book also have something more to offer, some kind of interesting story behind them about the map maker, about history, about how the map maybe even changed history, all sorts of different things. So you don't even have to love maps to love this book, because it's basically a book of interesting stories that happen to be about beautiful maps.
Published by National Geographic Books, the title is All Over the Map, A Cartographic Odyssey by Greg Miller and Betsy Mason, with whom it's been our pleasure to chat for the last few minutes. Betsy, nice to meet you. Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks. I really enjoyed it.
Sure. So long now.
Bye.
You're a map person and you enjoy maps? I really do. I can sometimes, instead of putting a book off the shelf, pull out a map and look at it for a while with a cup of coffee. Yeah. And Google Maps, you know, Google Earth. Well, you can waste a lot of time looking at that on your PC or your phone or your laptop or whatever device. Maps. Much more to come. Stick around, because next on the It's Your Turn program, we're going to be talking about diabetes in pets, particularly dogs and cats, and how you can manage that disease in pets. Our guest will be Dr. Catherine Sarpong, veterinarian, doctor of veterinary medicine, and we'll be chatting with her in just a moment on this Friday. Stick around. Back with more of It's Your Turn right after these words. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. We're going to be talking about the health of your pet, dogs and cats, and specifically diabetes on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest joining us by telephone is Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Catherine Sarpong. Doctor, nice to have you with us here for a few minutes today.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here talking about pet diabetes.
So obviously pets, our dogs and cats, can get diabetes, eh?
They can. And November's Diabetes Awareness Month, and I'm here with Merck Animal Health to remind folks that their cats and dogs are people too. They can also get diabetes, which is a problem of blood sugar regulation.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particular signs or symptoms that we might look for, let's say in Fido, to indicate that there may be a diabetes problem?
So one of the biggest symptoms that my pet parents tell me when they come in the room is that their dog or cat has been drinking more and urinating more. So the dog may be going to the bathroom more on a walk, or the kitty cat filling up the litter box more than usual, or accidents may be happening in the house when normally they would not have accidents. Those are symptoms of diabetes and should be taken to their veterinarian and have checked out. There's also a great quiz and list of other symptoms of diabetes on the website petdiabetesmonth.com. It's a great resource for owners to go to and look and see if if they can take a quiz if their pet's at increased risk or not.
Petdiabetes.com, that's the address?
Petdiabetesmonth.com.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Petdiabetesmonth.com. We'll repeat that again before we wrap up here. Make sure everybody has it correctly. So, is it fatal? Can it be managed just like we manage diabetes in humans?
Right. The earlier you catch it, the easier it is to manage, and it's absolutely manageable. These dogs can live a long, healthy life. Kitty cats can go on being cats with this disease. We manage it with a couple of different avenues. One is diet. Usually when they get diagnosed, their diet is adjusted, and we aim to get them to a normal body weight. And then we put them on an insulin regimen typically. So their insulin is something that's given by injection. Sounds scary, but owners learn to do this very well. There's a number of different insulins on the market, from human insulins that we use in pets to pet-specific insulins. And the veterinarian and owner and pet will kind of decide which is the best choice for that particular patient.
I don't know why I have this in the back of my mind, doctor. I have no veterinary training or anything, but I was under the impression that insulin came from pigs. Was I dreaming
so
that?
That's right. Lots of insulins do come from pigs. There's different types of insulin that have different sources, but wow, great for you for your trivia of the day.
So cats can get diabetes too. Same sort of signs and symptoms that we might look for in a cat?
So same symptoms in a kitty cat. An older, chubby kitty cat is a high risk candidate for diabetes. So those older, chubby kitty cats, especially if you start to see them drinking a lot, you're refilling that water bowl often, or they've always been chubby and suddenly they start losing a little bit of weight, very common symptom of diabetes.
So this kind of mirrors what is a risk factor for diabetes in humans, being overweight, being obese, right?
Right. They are very similar. So there's things you can control and things you can't. And, you know, we can't control what breed our pet is once we've adopted that great miniature poodle or pug. They're at increased risk from their genetics, but we can help them by keeping them lean and exercised so that they have a good body mass.
Dr. Catherine Sarpong, listeners, by the way, is a graduate of Texas A&M College of Veterinary Medicine. That's one of the really prestigious veterinary colleges in the United States. She has started several veterinary practices. In fact, she also published a groundbreaking study on parvovirus in the Journal of American Veterinary Medicine. What's parvo, by the way? Kind of parenthetical here, but what is that?
It's a virus that affects dogs that have not been vaccinated, and a deadly intestinal virus.
So you have been practicing for some years. Do you also do surgery, doctor?
I do, absolutely. And you know, it's much easier to do surgery on a healthy patient, so those well-managed diabetics are a much better choice than the unknown diabetic. So,
say we have healthy dogs and cats, pets. Do you have any tips on how we can prevent them from developing diabetes in the future?
Absolutely. So regular annual checkups at your veterinarian, super helpful. The vet can let you know if they're starting to put on a little bit of extra weight that maybe you haven't noticed, or if there's a trend going on. When they check their blood sugar level, if it's slightly high or higher than we expect it to be, that can be an early symptom. Keeping them well exercised, so getting that leash out even when the weather is not ideal, and still taking them for the walk or playing with that cat inside, these are all great ways to prevent diabetes.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that we have to be more concerned about exercise with cats, because most people take their dog out, you know, a few times a day. Not so much with cats, so they can tend to be lazier sometimes, right?
They can be, and it's oftentimes better to have two cats than one, because they will play with each other.
Oh.
But to remember that we've brought them inside to keep them healthy and to have a better life expectancy, but we need to provide them with climbing spaces inside, so like those cat climbing trees, toys to chase, laser pointers to go after. All these things are great ways for a cat to stay happy and healthy.
I know a little bit about, I've done actually a couple of interviews with people about diabetes in humans, and I know there are two different types. There's type 2, and then there's another type of diabetes. Is it the same in dogs and cats, or is it just one type of diabetes they get?
So they tend to get almost exclusively a developed diabetes over time. So we see this disease not in puppies and kittens. We see it in older animals and cats and dogs. So it's one where their cells in their pancreas have stopped making the insulin, and they've developed a resistance to insulin in their body. So it's a gradual onset disease in cats and dogs.
Are there any other pets, some exotic pets, that can develop diabetes, or are we looking specifically at dogs and cats here?
There are some exotic pets that develop diabetes. I really am not the expert on that subject, but we do see it in some other species as well.
Mm-hmm. Where can our pet owners, our pet lovers, learn more about pet diabetes, especially this month, Diabetes Awareness Month?
That's right. So PetDiabetesMonth.com, that website, again, is PetDiabetesMonth.com. Great information there about the disease, managing the disease, the different strategies for prevention, and there's a quiz there as well that your owners can take.
By the way, the only way to treat it is with injections. You can't, you know, put it in their ration. You can't take it orally. You got to give them a shot.
It does have to be given by injection. So there's a few animals that after they've been on injections a while won't require lifelong injections. But for most animals, it's a lifelong regimen.
How often do you have to do that, doctor?
Most animals are on a twice-a-day injection schedule.
Oh, wow. So that's a pretty rigorous schedule for pet lovers, twice a day.
It is a big commitment, but we've had owners that have been surprised at how it fits into their life, and I've taught teenage pet sitters how to give these injections. So, it is possible for the pet and owner to continue their lifestyle.
And the pet can live just as long as they ordinarily would if the diabetes is properly managed?
They can, absolutely.
Okay, good information from Dr. Catherine Sarpong. Doctor, nice to talk with you today. Thanks for spending a little time with us here.
Thanks so much. Appreciate you.
Sure. So long now.
Bye.
Pets can get diabetes, especially dogs and cats. So be on the lookout for that. It's the Friday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Much more to come, so I hope you can stick with us for a while. I do want to remind you, it was Monday of this week here on the program, right, that we talked with Matthew Kramer? Yeah, the musical director and conductor of the Butler County Symphony Orchestra, Matthew Kramer. Tomorrow night, it's the family concert night. Well, it's a concert for everyone, but it's especially family-friendly tomorrow night at Butler Intermediate High School Auditorium because the symphony will be performing music from Harry Potter, music from several, five or six of the Harry Potter films, music from the soundtrack. They're calling it the Magical Music of Harry Potter. And also on the program for the symphony tomorrow night will be the Sorcerer's Apprentice from Fantasia. Children are encouraged to come in costume. Still got the Halloween costumes out from a couple of nights ago. Take the kids and have them enjoy the music of Harry Potter. Nice introduction to symphony music. For ticket information, you can go online at butlersymphony.org. butlersymphony.org. Tickets for adults are $25, $8 for students. And again, that's tomorrow night. And by the way, Matthew Kramer will be giving a pre-concert talk at 6:30, so you can learn a little bit about the music in advance of hearing it. And then concert time is 7:30 tomorrow night at Butler Intermediate High School Auditorium. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, our next guest, and actually it's going to be a second listen to an interview that I did several years ago with a retired special former FBI agent. His name is Robert Fitzpatrick, and he shared the story of the discovery and the apprehension of Whitey Bulger, who had been hiding in plain sight, so to speak, for quite a few years, living with his girlfriend. And finally he was discovered, apprehended, taken into custody. He was put on trial. He was convicted, sent to prison. He was a really bad guy, convicted of several murders, several homicides. And this week he was found dead in his cell at a prison in Connecticut. He had been transferred to another prison, and the very next day was found dead in the cell. They're still investigating, but it seems obvious that he was killed by some fellow inmates in the prison. That's something that is not totally unheard of in prisons. So with the death of Whitey Bulger, I thought it might be nice to come back and revisit that interview that I did with Robert Fitzpatrick. I was hoping that we still had it in the archives of It's Your Turn, and indeed, we do. So we'll take a quick break and then listen to that interview with Robert Fitzpatrick. You're listening to the Friday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Stick around. We'll be back in just a moment.
That's one of the more recognizable doo-wop songs, recorded by Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, even Elvis. But most well-known is sung by the legendary Marcells. See them perform live at Tanglewood, your hometown center for entertainment, Saturday, November 10th. Doors open at 6. BYOB dinner by Chef George at 7. Showtime at 8. Tickets, $25. Call 287-0021 for reservations.
Welcome, listeners. Great to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program today. If you're joining us a little bit late, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visits with us by telephone today. He is Robert Fitzpatrick, retired FBI special agent and the author of Betrayal, an incredible story that we're going to hear about from Robert. First of all, Mr. Fitzpatrick, nice to meet you. It's great to be able to talk with you for a few minutes here today.
And my pleasure, Dave.
This story reads like a novel, a crime novel. I have to pinch myself every once in a while to realize that it's absolutely true. And it's about a name, Whitey Bulger, that people are going to be hearing a lot about here this summer, right?
Oh, he's going to be in the news. Probably the upcoming trial will be the trial of the century.
Mm-hmm. Whitey Bulger was arrested after years and years of trying to track him down. I think it was years. Two summers ago. Is that right, Robert?
16 years. And you're right, two summers ago.
Mm-hmm. You were involved in tracking him down for the majority of that time. And, of course, you were a special agent in charge in Boston for some years as well. We want to talk about that. We want to talk about how the whole betrayal fits into this.
Okay.
But I think a good place to start would be to just talk for a minute about this Whitey Bulger guy. Who was he? And why was he the target of such an unending investigation and passionate investigation by you?
Right. Well, first of all, this is going to be a sensational trial because Whitey Bulger was the head of the Irish organized crime group in Boston and New England. Secondly, he became the top echelon informant for the FBI. My experience out of Mississippi when I was down there with the bombings in Mississippi, mm-hmm. was that you can't have the head of a gang as an informant because, in effect, you'd be directing the gang. So from that point of view, Dave, what you have is a conundrum right from the very beginning. Then when I open up the murder cases on him, I'm opening murder cases on an FBI informant who, in effect, is being charged with killing other FBI informants.
Mm.
So that creates a super situation. Then you got the Mass State Police thinking that the FBI agents are running around with this bad Bulger guy, the head of the organized crime guy, but they don't know that he's an informant. The FBI can't tell him he's an informant. So you got that. So the betrayal comes about because the state police think the FBI has gone bad, when in fact, it turns out, the FBI has gone bad because the informant handler is now in jail, in prison, will be there for the next 30 years. And, of course, Bulger has become a betrayal guy in that he's still working his own scam and pretending that he is an FBI informant. And so when I go out and talk to him, he tells me he's not an informant, and that leads right up to the trial coming up, where basically his defense is going to be, I was never an informant. In fact, I paid the FBI to get me the information. And secondly, I had immunity from the strike force who let me do all the things that I did. And therefore, I had a license to kill, a license to go out there and do stuff. So you can imagine, Dave, what this is going to look like as this trial unfolds.
Listeners, we're talking with Robert Fitzpatrick. He's the author of, and I want to make sure you have the title of his book, Betrayal, Whitey Bulger and the FBI Agent Who Fought to Bring Him Down, Betrayal. I'm holding my review copy as a paperback copy, Robert, but it was published a couple of years ago. Is it being republished in light of the trial, or what's the story this summer?
Dave, I think they will. It was published January of,
11, I think.
11 yeah. or 12, yeah. Maybe 12. But anyway, it sold pretty well, and I wrote the book from the inside. This is a book like no other book that's out there about Whitey Bulger. It's a book from the inside. It tries to tell the reader about how this corruption evolved, and it also tries to tell the reader how the betrayals evolved, mm-hmm. and how Bulger co-opted the entire criminal justice system in Boston.
Folks, a little bit about our guest, Robert Fitzpatrick, so you'll realize that he knows what he's talking about. He joined the military at age 18 after getting a degree from St. Peter's College, joined the FBI in the mid-60s, and moved up the ranks pretty quickly. And you were involved in some, well, all I got to do is mention these cases, Robert, and people are going to remember them, the infamous Mississippi burning civil rights murders, James Earl Ray.
We called it bombings in Mississippi, but I was undercover for about a year and a half working against the supremacists, the white supremacist gangs.
And you recovered the rifle that led to the arrest of James Earl Ray?
Yeah, I was a night supervisor. I was on the scene when James Earl Ray pulled the trigger and killed Martin King. I was investigating it, and I found the rifle hidden. We also found some other evidence, and through that we tracked down Ray in London, brought him back, and prosecuted him.
So for these and other jobs, your reward was you were promoted, you were transferred to Boston, and one of your first orders of business was to interview this Whitey Bulger guy face-to-face, and he was supposedly an informant. Did you suspect right away that there was something that wasn't on the up and up here?
You know, Dave, with the major cases that I had, I obviously had informants with all those cases. And all the informants I ever had are basically people who want to help the FBI. And so there's a nice understanding, you know, we get along and so forth. However, when I go out and meet this guy, he's got a baseball cap on with glasses, got a strong-arm shirt on, he got his arms folded, and basically he's in my face right from the very beginning. So I don't say nothing, you know. I figure, you know, the guy's a little discourteous, and I try to keep my head up and watching all this and talking to him. But what he tells me is, look, I'm not an informant, he tells me. He tells me he's the head of the gang. He tells me that he's got his own informants and so forth and so on. And right away I say to myself, well, hey, and you know what? I'm going to close you. You're not going to be an informant. I don't tell him that. I tell me that. I go back, and basically what happens, Dave, is I present this recommendation. And I get static. You know, I get a lot of people who don't want to close them. The fact they want to keep them open, and I object to that. It's like being in the military. A general tells you to do something, and it's a quasi-military organization in the FBI. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm in effect telling my superiors that, no, this guy should be closed. And when they don't close them, I open up murder cases because, remember, I start accusing this guy of killing three of my informants, and here you got an FBI informant killing FBI informants, and that makes for a heck of a situation in trial, particularly, and in reality. And so I was, you know, stonewalled and put back several times. Kind of a tenacious guy, so, you know, obviously I hit a wall at different times, but make a long story short, he took off after a period. He went on a lam for 16 years, and there are some people who believe that he was allowed to do that, and there are other people who believe that's not true.
Well, you didn't give up on him, and I need to take a quick break here, and I have a few more minutes to chat with Robert. But, folks, let me just read you a couple of sentences here to show you the drama of this. And while Robert was talking there, I was able to find the page where you were one of your superiors in Boston. Greenleaf, I think, was his name. This is the conversation you had whenever he ordered you to close the investigation. Right. And let me just read a couple of sentences here. "I can't do that," I told him. I don't think you heard what I just told you. I heard you. He hesitated before responding and then said, "Close the case, Fitz." "Is that an order?" "You bet it is." "Then I respectfully decline to follow it." Now, this is good stuff, folks. And you said, in effect, look, I'll follow the order if I get a written instruction from the head of the FBI. And the next day, that's exactly what you got.
and Dave, I mean, that's like, I never had that in my entire career.
Wow.
I mean, it was just so off the wall. And the whole case is billed by the Congress. They had the Reform Committee came down, and they billed it as the worst case in the history of law enforcement.
Folks, we'll take a quick break. We have a few more minutes to chat with Robert Fitzpatrick, author of Betrayal. And it's all about Whitey Bulger, and he's going to be in the news a lot this summer because his trial is scheduled to start this month. We'll be back with more on It's Your Turn here on WISR right after these words.
I was just 49 when I started getting mail from AARP. AARP? Shoot, I was just getting started in life. Then I hit my 60s and retirement was on my mind. The big question was, did I prepare? What about healthcare? Are my finances in order? Not just for my wife and me, but for the kids and grandkids. I got the answers I needed from attorney Michael Pater, specializing in elder law, long-term care, Medicaid, and wills and estate planning, is attorney Michael Pater in the Handicap Accessible Morgan Center. Phone 287-7724.
Just want to remind people, if you're tuning in here, we're taking another listen to an interview that I actually did several years ago following the discovery and the apprehension of Whitey Bulger. And this was before he went to trial, before he was convicted, before he went to prison. And, of course, he was found dead in his prison cell earlier this week. It was a big story, big national story. I remember that I had interviewed a former FBI special agent who helped to hunt Whitey Bulger down. And so I thought we'd dig it out of the archives and take another listen to it. So obviously the references that you hear to the upcoming trial and so on and so forth, that took place several years ago. Okay, let's listen to the second and the final portion then of that interview that we did with Robert Fitzpatrick. Welcome back, listeners. If you're joining us a little bit late, Dave Malarkey is my name. Our guest is Robert Fitzpatrick, retired FBI special agent and author of Betrayal, Whitey Bulger and the FBI agent who fought to bring him down. And that's just what you did, Robert. Did you? You eventually found realized that it was necessary for you to resign, right? You were being told to do things you couldn't do.
I tell that story in Betrayal, and that's part of the betrayal, obviously, that things got so bad, and I had to go against my oath. And what I told him was, I'm not going against my oath. I took an oath to uphold the Constitution and protect the citizens. And so when they wouldn't let me do what I had to do, I said, I'm out of here. You know, you guys do what you want to do, but I'm not being a part of that. And so, yeah, I just left. I just said, hey, that's it. I'm through. And on the outside, I continued to work the case as a PI, private investigator. And a lot of information was developed. There was a lot of stuff brought out. And it kind of kept the case alive, Dave, you see. Because a lot of people, you can imagine, they wanted to drop this thing. It became a hot potato, and I wouldn't let it go. I just kept on it and kept on it and developed information along the way. And here we are this week, the start of the trial. And I'll obviously be testifying, and my testimony has been going on for 20 years.
Wow. Yeah, as I recall, and this is a while back that they took Bulger into custody almost 2 years ago now, wasn't there a woman involved here that he'd been staying with him or something like that? Was that the big break?
Catherine Gregg was her name. And this guy has always had a squeeze, as we call him, mm-hmm. on the arm, if you will. And he abandoned the first one to go on a lam and took Catherine with him. And Catherine stayed with him during this period. And quite frankly, you know, without telling any secrets, my thing is I believe she just got so tired of the guy that she dimed him, that she was the one that probably set him up and got him caught. That has not come out. That's not been revealed or any way, but my investigative sense tells me that.
Was that the thing that eventually brought him down, that you were able to get him?
Well, there was a lady from Iceland, if you can imagine, you know, and this lady from Iceland spots him. God only knows how that happened, but she's the one that got the reward, and she's out of sight now. No one's been able to find her or talk to her, so that part of the story, Dave, is still open. That's still that's going to be one of these things that's going to become a conspiracy kind of thing that's going to go on for a long time.
And by the way, this guy was captured in California. He's
Santa
on trial.
Santa Monica, California. Yeah.
These are not petty crimes he's being charged with. It's multiple murders, isn't it, Robert?
19 murders for the trial. He's involved in at least 43 murders overall. And there are probably other murders that he's involved in that no one really has come forth, and I'm sure that'll probably come out too. But he's also a guy that made a ton of bucks, you know, through his activities, And when they got him, they found $800,000 worth of cash in his wall.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, this is a story and a half.
Were there twists and turns over the, I mean, because you were hunting for this guy for what, 16, 17 years, something like that?
16 years, yeah.
Did you think that he had slipped?
People wish that he was dead. You know, it's come to the point now where you have to understand that he was aided and abetted and protected. I mean, these are not just allegations. Some of this is true.
Mm-hmm.
And so those people will not want to be around when he decides to testify about some of the help that he did get. And that's going to be quite a story in and of itself if and when it comes out during trial.
Mm-hmm. Are you unhappy that you found yourself forced to leave the FBI? Do you wish you could have stayed until retirement?
Yeah. That, you know, in many ways. But, Dave, I couldn't stay under those circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I was going to go against my oath. And I would have had to. They would have... I would have been charged with insubordination if I didn't do some of the things they wanted me to do. And quite honestly, they retaliated when I did leave. I had a lot of retaliation. I'm a guy that's out there, lone wolf, in many ways, that is saying these things. But the FBI, no one knew that part of the FBI at that time. So it's only this being discovered over the years through trials. So I testified, what, 2 or 3 years ago? I've been testifying at least 3 trials. And in the 3 trials, the FBI was found guilty of wrongful murder in this guy's murder of the informants. And so they've also been fined $101 million. Now, I don't have to go into court and say they're bad guys. That's there already. But the other thing is that I'm not for Bulger, and I'm not against the FBI. I'm for the truth. I'm for this thing finally being told in a way that is truthful and that would help the criminal justice system, not hurt it.
Folks, the whole story in great detail is told in the book Betrayal, Whitey Bulger and the FBI agent who fought to bring him down. And that agent is Robert Fitzpatrick, the author of the book, and our guest here on It's Your Turn. Wow, this is exciting stuff. I'm about two-thirds of the way through the book. I'm anxious to finish it now, Robert.
Well, good luck, Dave, and I hope you enjoy the rest of it.
And I'll be watching the trial with interest. Thanks for talking with us today. Thanks very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Once again, don't want to confuse anyone. That's an interview that we did several years ago with the former FBI special agent, Robert Fitzpatrick. And by the way, they're still investigating the killing of Whitey Bulger in prison early this week, but the early speculation is that it was payback for his becoming an FBI informant. So, interesting story. More to come on It's Your Turn. We're going to be talking with an award-winning National Geographic photographer. Coming up on the next segment of the program, his name is Mark Thiessen. And also a little bit later on the program still today, Leadership Hacks. One of our sponsors on the program is Miller's Shoes. You know, they just celebrated another anniversary. Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street, downtown Butler. 126 years in business. That is just phenomenal. Think about that. 126 years. And there they are, still fitting everyone in the family with all of the shoes and boots they need. And yes, boots, because I don't have to tell you what's on the doorstep. Here we are in November now, and bad weather will be upon us very soon. If you need boots or overshoes, they've got a great supply at Miller's Shoes. I can make sure that you're ready for the coming snow and slush and ice and everything else. Plus, tennis shoes, athletic shoes for everybody in the family. They have all the famous brand names there. Right under one roof, you don't have to go to 2 or 3 different stores. They've got Nike, New Balance, Saucony, Rockport, Keds, Skechers, Easy Spirit, Asics, ProPet. They're all right there. I like New Balance myself, but you know, everybody has their own favorite athletic shoe. You'll also find brand name shoes, names that you know you can trust. Timberland is shoes and boots. Boy, they make great boots, Timberland. Rockport, another great name in shoes. You'll find those at Miller's Shoes. Trotters for women's shoes. SAS Comfort Shoes, America's favorite comfort shoes. Miller's your local location for those as well. American made, too, by the way. 126 years in business. Miller's Shoes. You get great selection. You get that great Miller's price, that great Miller's fit. And you get a big smile from the chipper ends, too. Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in the heart of downtown Butler.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
How long, listeners, have you been looking at the gorgeous pictures in National Geographic? For most of us, a long, long time. We're going to be talking with an award-winning National Geographic staff photographer on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey, and our guest is Mark Thiessen. Mark, nice to meet you. Great to have you with us here today.
Hi, Dave. Great to be here.
There is a new collection of photographs that have been gathered into a book called National Geographic Spectacle, Rare and Astonishing Photographs. And you contributed to the foreword to this book, I understand, Mark. Is that right?
Yes, I did. And this is a book in the classic National Geographic coffee table book.
Mm-hmm.
Over 200 photographs, and it's really been a pleasure to work on it.
National Geographic, folks, has been around for 130 years, believe it or not. I had no idea it was that long, although I have pretty vivid memories, Mark, of even in elementary school, looking through National Geographic. I mean, even before I was reading a lot, the pictures were captivating even for a small child.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, one of my greatest pleasures was when I was a kid, I would cut out the pictures of National Geographic magazine and use them for school projects.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I started working here, I was a photo intern back in 1986, and I was able to work side by side with some of those same photographers whose pictures I cut out when I was in grade school.
Wow.
And that's one of the real special moments in my life.
I guess. Dream job. Well, tell us a little bit about this book. I understand that it's divided into four chapters. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, there's four chapters. It's over 200 pictures. The chapters are chaos, surprise, beauty, and awe. And the editorial team divided the pictures up into those chapters so that it just kind of gives the pictures a new meaning. And they're often juxtaposed next to other pictures that are very different, but do have a common theme, whether it be their color scheme or the composition or something else about the picture. As a photographer, I can tell you that it's rare when the light and the composition and the moment all line up to produce a photograph so great that when you look at your camera, you're like, "Did I take that picture? This picture's too good for me to take. I can't believe I shot that." And this book is full of those kind of pictures.
The photographs of animals, plants, landscapes, all of the above.
People, everything.
Yeah.
And this is from our archive, most of these pictures are from our magazine coverages. So some of them were ones that were never published, and it's a great chance to get those pictures out in the public for people to see.
Are any of your photographs in this collection, Mark?
Yeah, I've got five or six pictures in it. Let's see. One of them is in near the back in the section called Awe, and it's on page 374, and it is a picture of me in a vehicle going through a forest fire.
Wow.
this is something that I've been photographing wildland fires for years. This is part of my one of my passions. And I was at a fire in Seeley Lake, Montana, and the we were doing a backfire. So a backfire is when you burn all the vegetation between a road and the advancing fire, therefore robbing it of fuel. And then the theory is the fire goes out, and this was a two-mile-long backburn, and everything was going great until the wind shifted. And then the smoke column bent over top of us, and in that smoke column are embers. And those embers fell into the green, across the road into the green side where the fire, we were trying to keep the fire out of. And you could see through the trees that fire got established there. He was getting word on his radio, he being the division supervisor I was with, who's in charge of the people on that fire, that the fire had jumped the road at several places. This is bad news. This is a very dangerous situation. So he radioed all his people to evacuate. He and I were the deepest in on this road. We hopped in his vehicle and drove through walls of smoke and fire. And, you know, I'm taking pictures the whole time because I never know what's going to happen. And ended up with this picture. And it's one of those pictures that, that puts you right there. It's a picture that puts you in a familiar place, the passenger seat of a pickup, in a very unfamiliar situation, being surrounded by forest fire.
You actually, because you have been documenting wildland fires for some years, you actually became a certified wildland firefighter, did you not?
I did. In the 90s, about late 90s, about 20 years ago, when I started this project, I, at the recommendation of somebody in the fire world, said, you know, Mark, if you want to do this, you got to do it right. Become a certified wildland firefighter. And so I went through the training, not so that I could fight fire, but so that I could know how to be safe. Because fire is very, being around fire is very counterintuitive. And that way, I'm not a liability to the other firefighters. And through the years, I've developed lots of very strong relationships with wildland firefighters. And they know I've got their back and they've got my back. And they welcome me out there, and this is the kind of the magic of National Geographic, is that we don't just do a story like this lightly. We go in, and it's a big, heavy lift. And for me to do several stories on fire that I've done for the magazine, all started with me doing this as a personal project and developing these relationships so that I can bring our readers pictures that they're never going to see anywhere else from right inside of the fire line.
Can you give us give us a little hint of what else is in here? Do you have another favorite or two photograph, even something that you didn't shoot?
Well, one that I'm looking at right now is the lead picture into the chapter called Chaos. And I didn't take this picture, but it was taken in Iceland of a volcano at night that was erupting. And during that eruption, the static charged particles in the ash that's billowing out of this volcano, there are these lightning bolts that light up the volcano and light up the ash cloud and the surrounding snowy landscape.
Wow.
And it just looks otherworldly to me and beautiful at the same time. And this is really, I think, a picture that really goes to the theme of this book. It's a spectacle. These are spectacles of our natural world.
Sometimes you get lucky when you're taking a photograph, but a lot of people who are not professional photographers might not understand the incredible planning, the commitment, and everything that goes into getting that shot. Sometimes you work on it for a long time, won't you?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, you just don't walk outside and take these pictures. You just don't walk outside your home and take these pictures. You know, each shot in this book, and for the pictures that I take for the magazine, takes planning and commitment and dogged determination. Sometimes mixed in with some dumb luck and what I call a little bit of magic to make it all work. And one photographer, Jim Richardson, one of our famous National Geographic photographers, said, you know, to make better pictures, you just got to stand in front of more interesting stuff. So showing up is part of it, but you have to be ready, and you have to be anticipating what's going to happen next. Am I in the right place for the next 3 seconds, the next 3 minutes, or the next 3 days?
Did you start taking pictures when you were a little kid, Mark? I mean, somebody get you, I don't know, like an Instamatic or something like that when you were in elementary school?
Yeah, they did, in fact. And I started out taking pictures when I was very young. And this is in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And I had a paper route. And before I delivered the papers, I looked at all the photographs in that newspaper and took note of who shot what. And then I would deliver, the paper on my paper route. My first published picture was when I was 14 years old. I was too young to drive. I had saved my paper route money to buy a scanner so I could hear the police and fire calls. And a car, I'd heard about a car that had been hit by a train. So I said, Mom, let's go. So it was like 7 in the morning. We hopped in our Ford Pinto. Off we went. And fortunately, the driver, his car stalled on the tracks. Fortunately, the driver jumped out. He was unhurt. The train made a spectacular wreckage of his car. I shot that wreckage, dropped the roll of film off at the newspaper. And that afternoon, on my doorstep, at 2:30, was a stack of newspapers with my picture on the cover.
Wow.
And I made sure I porched every one of those newspapers. From then on, it was just me doing photography and photojournalism at a young age, and doors kept opening because people saw this young, motivated kid who wanted to do good work.
I've never talked with a National Geographic photographer before. You've probably been all over the world, haven't you, on assignment?
Yes, I have. You know, a lot of third world countries with bad food, but it's been quite a journey, and you know, lots of stories.
Well, there's some magnificent pictures in this collection, folks. Spectacle, rare and astonishing photographs. I mean, we're talking about everything from desert sandstorms to depth of a blue ice cave, and a whole lot more. So give us a tip for us amateur photographers who might want to get a good shot every once in a while, other than standing near good stuff or whatever your mentor told you about, Mark.
One thing that you can never go wrong with getting up early and getting that gorgeous morning light.
Oh, yeah.
When that light is on the horizon. And sometimes it might seem like an overcast day, but sometimes, you know, if you're in an area where you can see the horizon, the sun will come up and there'll be like a break for maybe 10 minutes where the sun is streaming across the landscape. And landscape photos are always beautiful at early morning or late afternoon light. That's the best time to take those kind of pictures.
Yeah, you get it once in a while in the late afternoon, but the light seems to be more fleeting to me in the late afternoon. You can get some, you get the long shadows, but it's not quite the same as the morning light.
Yeah, and a lot of times, depending on where you are in the country, thunderstorms or clouds will build up during the day, and they can block that gorgeous light. That's why I'm more partial to early morning, where the skies tend to be clearer.
Where is this book available? Bookstores or online or from National Geographic, Mark? Where do we find it?
So Spectacle is available wherever books are sold, online at our website, nationalgeographic.com. It makes a great holiday gift. Anyone you give this to is going to love it. It's something that I'm very proud of that we have done.
And it's a big book, too. Spectacle, Rare and Astonishing Photographs from the Archives of National Geographic. One of their staff photographers, award-winning photographer, Mark Thiessen, chatting with us. Mark, nice to have you with us today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Dave. My pleasure.
Sure. Have a good day now.
The Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot has delicious, all-natural, free-roaming turkeys and chickens to make your Thanksgiving meal special this year. Their birds are handled with extreme care and are preservative and additive-free. Buy your turkey frozen today or get it fresh right before the big holiday meal. For the tastiest turkeys and chickens in Western PA, call the Jones Turkey Farm, 724-352-2450, or visit jonesturkeyfarm.com. The Jones Turkey Farm in Cabot, quite simply the best.
Hey folks, have you heard about Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center? Yeah, they're located just off Newcastle Road, Shockey Lane, right behind King's and Villa Grande. Going Postal Butler. They package your items for shipping. And that takes care of a situation that sometimes can be a real bother. You know, you got to get the wrapping paper, the string, the tape, whatever you need. They'll do it for you. And you can ship any way you want to, FedEx, UPS, U.S. Postal Service. They will package your items for shipping at Gowan Postal Butler. Other services they offer, copying, scanning, faxing, mailbox rentals, custom boxes. They have an official notary, also greeting cards, even a lottery agent. Gowan Postal Butler, 140 Shockey Lane. That's just off Newcastle Road, right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants. It's in the Shockey mini storage area. For more information, give them a call, 724-841-0044. Gowan Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. Coming up on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR listeners, I'm Dave Malarkey. We're going to be talking about leadership hacks, clever shortcuts to boost your impact and results. It's a new book by Scott Stein, who joins us via the telephone to chat for a few minutes. Scott, nice to have you with us here today.
Yeah, Dave, great to be here.
What inspired you to write this book, Leadership Hacks?
Yeah, well, essentially, I've been working with leaders for about the last 25 years. And I've been in Sydney, Australia for 23 of those years. I grew up in America. And over time, I've worked with hundreds, if not thousands, of different leaders. And what I found is some of them had these great shortcuts, these little practical processes that allowed them to get more things done in less time. And over time, I would kind of share the process with other leaders. And eventually, somebody said, oh, can you kind of write this down? Because I want to share it not just with my team, but my whole organization. And eventually I was persuaded to write the book.
Is there any secret formula to achieving more as a leader?
Yeah, I think it's about being smarter and being clever. So, and what I mean by smarter, it's not so much about IQ. It's about how can we actually do things faster, but do them in a way that actually is going to get more done rather than less. And I think for leaders to do that, they've got to be aware of what they're doing. They've got to be aware of where they're spending their time. You know, and it's not your traditional time management series, you know, Franklin Covey from the 1980s. It's about how do I do steps and take a process, either with myself or with my people, to actually get more done.
The term hacks may not be familiar to all of our listeners. Just what is a leadership hack, Scott?
Yeah, so most people have heard of the word hack before, and essentially a hack, you know, that was really kind of coined in the 1970s, 1980s, and those were the kind of the computer IT geniuses that would actually find backdoor access to computer systems. And over time, the word hack has actually developed to improve and actually be seen as doing something for good. So when Facebook was doing their launch to become an IPO, Mark Zuckerberg wrote a manifesto called The Hacker's Way. And even today, Facebook have an annual hacking competition, which is about how do we do things faster? Let's break the old systems and find ways to do things faster. And from a leader perspective, it's the same thing. A leadership hack is anything that helps you accomplish more and less time. They can be shortcuts, not commonly known. They can be simplified steps that make a task easier to do. And quite often, it's a fast-track process that's really practical to allow people to get things done.
You identify three main keys in your book. Can you walk us through these three main keys?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you think about most people have had a manager or a boss that was terrible, right? I don't know if you've ever had one, Dave. I know I have, where they were just hopeless. It was shocking. And we've also had the opposite. I know I've had some amazing leaders and amazing managers. And what I've found is the managers that are normally seen as amazing, they get more things done, but they've mastered three keys. And if you want to hack your leadership, you've got to master this. The first thing is their mindset. They're actually open to learning new ways of doing things. I was doing something with a program, and there was this older gentleman, I mean older, he's probably in his 70s. There's a group of CEOs, and as I was working with them, he was, you know, every so often he'd take this little notebook out of his back pocket and would write a couple notes. And I talked to him during one of the breaks, going, oh, mate, what are you doing? He said, well, what I'm doing is I'm capturing some of your ideas. They're great. And I found out later on he was a multi-millionaire, if not a billionaire, in his 70s, and here he was still learning. And I think that's one of the big keys. You know, we've got to have a mindset that allows us to hack and look for new solutions. The second thing is about your approach. Your approach is, what are your practical steps that you're going to take? They can't be overly complicated. It can't be some complex theory from the 1980s on leadership that some professor at some stuffy university created that's not in the real world. It has to be something practical. And the third area is about impact. Leaders and managers, it's about how they impact their people. How do they mobilize them to get things done? So if you can't mobilize people or impact people in a way that inspires them to achieve more, usually they're going to actually go the opposite direction, right? Which means you're not going to achieve what you need to. So those are really the three keys that a leader needs to actually get across to hack their approach.
We're talking with Scott Stein, author of Leadership Hacks. Mr. Stein has helped many, many leaders implement fast-track strategies to improve results. He's a leading international speaker and an expert on leadership and influence. There are also some common distractions or obstacles that pop up. Talk about those a little bit, Scott Stein.
Yeah, that one thing I found is there was, quite a few things that stop leaders from getting things done. There were common distractions. And I actually kind of profiled them in the book. And what I find is a lot of leaders experience these quite often. So it's important to get on top of them. The first distraction is what I call the lack of energy. You know, we live in a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week world where we're bombarded by digital information, news, work things. And what I find is a lot of CEOs, a lot of leaders, they just run out of puff. They run out of juice because they don't have the energy to bounce back. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of leaders do. They need to listen to what is their body and their energy telling them. How do they actually maintain it? Because if they actually haven't had a good night's sleep, if they haven't had time to kind of recharge the batteries, it's hard to think and be effective and efficient. That's one thing that they need to do. The other one is being aware of their mindset. You know, is their mindset, full of self-doubt? Are they questioning themselves? Or are they actually standing behind the decisions they made and backing the people around them? And that can be a massive distraction, kind of the voices that people have in their heads. The third one was about time fillers and what I call the biological need to be busy. There's something I call the busy syndrome. You know, everybody is always busy all the time, and I think sometimes people are just busy being busy. What that means is they're just doing time-filling activities that just make them feel like they're getting something done, but they're actually not. So I think that's something that you need to get on top of and be aware of what are those little biological fillers or those time wasters. The two other ones are what I call the external distractions. One is technology. Technology is a great tool, but if we don't manage our technology and control it, it will control us. So technology can be a distraction. Yeah, because, look at all the emails we get in. We get in over 140, 150 emails a day or more that have to be responded to. So we got to be aware of how do we get on top of this. There was a study that was just done by Harvard Business Review recently that looked at the impact if you have a smartphone. And even if you're not on it, sitting on your desk, you're on your computer or your laptop trying to get some work done, they found that that's a distraction to people. They kept going to their phone to check Facebook notifications, right? So that's actually something that you need to be aware of. You need to control the technology, which is the fourth distraction. And the fifth one is interruption. You need to be in a public plan office or workplace, you need to actually limit the interruptions that are going to steal your time.
We'll take a quick break. We have a few more minutes to chat with Scott Stein. We'll pick up our conversation with him here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick two is 2424. The pick three is 839839. The pick four, 2787. The pick five, 36622. Wild ball for each of those is 8. The treasure hunt is 15, 17, 21, 24, and 25. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
Welcome back. I'm Dave Malarkey, and on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR today, we're chatting with Scott Stein, author of Leadership Hacks, Clever Shortcuts to Boost Your Impact and Results. Boy, Before the break, Scott, you mentioned email, and that, that just seems to get worse every month for me. You come in the morning and you got, it seems like hundreds, in some cases it is hundreds of email. Talk us through the process of a four-step email inbox hack. What can we do?
Yeah, I think this is a big one. Dave, this is a really big one people have to get on top of. In fact, McKinsey Global Institute did a report and found that employees spend an average of 2.6 hours per day reading and answering emails, which means an average of 13 hours a week is lost time.
Wow.
So this definitely needs to be hacked. From an inbox perspective, what I found, the people that actually are doing this really well, the leaders that I studied, they follow a four-step process. So the first step in their inbox is they scan through. They don't read through every email and click on it. They do a quick scan, and their second step is delete. So they delete and get rid of the things that aren't relevant straight away. So visually, there's less clutter, and it doesn't sidetrack them. The third step is then to sort. Sort through what are the remaining emails, what are the higher priority ones, and then the fourth step is respond. And, of course, respond to the important ones first. So that's how you can hack your inbox. The other thing that you can do is hack the way you send emails. But what I found is if you want people to respond and take action on the emails that you send them, there's actually five outcomes that you will have from any email you send. And if you can put this outcome either in the subject line or at the very beginning of the email, you're going to make it easier for the respondents to actually do what you need them to do. The five specific outcomes are, first one is FYI, just something that they need to be aware of. The second one is, I need some information from you. Can you please give me the information? The third one is, I need you to make a decision on this because it's something that needs to be decided. The fourth one is about an action. I need you to take action on this. And the fifth one is, we need a meeting because the email isn't going to do it justice. So what I find is if you send emails, if you actually specify the outcome as one of those five at the very beginning of your email, that gives the receiver the context of how to actually read or respond to the email, which will save them time as well as you.
You had one interesting tip that I'm going to try. I saw in your book, make clearing your inbox a game. You suggest setting a time limit and then seeing if you can get through the whole list within that designated time, right?
Yeah, I think, gamifying things is a great thing, right? Anything that's a game that makes it fun rather than a chore is actually helping our mindset. And there was actually a book that was by Kevin Cruz. It was called The 15 Secret Successful People Know About Time Management. And what he did is he studied time management habits of billionaires and Olympic athletes, things like that. And he talks about a 3-2-1-0 system. So essentially, this is a bit of a game. I put the game part on it. You set your timer on your phone for 21 minutes, and you only check your email three times a day. So you do it morning, middle of the day, and night, and you have a 21-minute window to clear your email to zero. Now, I know a lot of people go, oh, there's no way I can only look at my email three times a day, and that's fine. I'm the same. Maybe you only do it once an hour, and maybe you only give yourself 5 minutes to clear it. The thing that I find is people that gamify it, they can hack through it and they can get through their emails and their inbox a lot quicker.
And a lot of people have a sound that they have, a ping that goes off or something whenever they get an email. You suggest it might be a good idea to turn that off too, huh?
Absolutely. Turn off notifications. Turn off Facebook notifications. Turn off email notifications. Because 9 times out of 10, the email you get or the notification you get isn't urgent and it's not important. What that means is that's going to keep distracting you from the flow and the focus of what you should have.
You also talk about something called an activity map to increase productivity. What's that all about, Scott Stein?
Yeah, what I find is a lot of people are not aware of where they're spending their time or where they're losing their time. So a really simple activity that I use with a lot of CEOs and a lot of leaders is I get them to look back to the past week or two, and I get them to map on a sheet, on one sheet of paper or on an iPad or a tablet, map where they've been focusing their activity, right? So in the circle, they make a little mind map. In the circle, they look at, my last 2 weeks, and then they have little arms or lines that come off of that, and they identify the areas they've been focusing on. And the trick that I get people to do is to put percentage of time next to those areas. And what I find, that's quite tricky, because most people are on mental autopilot. They're not aware of where they're spending the time. They just always say, I just never have enough time. But by mapping it, you can start seeing where have I been spending my time. There's a great app called GetHarvest, which is a free app that you can use that has little time logs. So if you want to actually kind of track your time, you can use that as well. But then the other piece of the app looking at your activity is then get a clean sheet of paper or a new screen on your iPad and actually map out ideally what should your activity be. Look at the main areas of responsibility, also do the percentage of time, and then compare what you've actually been doing versus what you ideally should be doing. And that'll give you a very clear and simple overview of what you should be changing.
All of your tips certainly very helpful in the workplace, but it occurs to me, Scott, this could be helpful even, you know, at home, in your personal life.
Absolutely. And what I find is, you know, the leaders and the managers that are the most inspirational are the ones that actually seem to be able to get on top of everything. They don't, you know, they've got this good balance at work, and they've got this good balance at home as well. And what I find is if you're more efficient and effective at work, quite often you're more efficient and effective at home, and you have more time to spend with the people that you love. And I think that's the challenge, right? We spend more working hours at work with our work colleagues